Can't change it. The light changes. I put in the body. It's gonna go out for everything.
But you can't stop it.
No, without making it one at a time, like make it each one that you need or whatever, which I didn't want to.
But it has the automatic faster as well.
For the 20 times it would work.
Of course.
Sorry guys, I'm looking for one. I lost my count. Go.
Did you, is the projector?
Yeah, I'm just, I lost the what is enlightenment essay. I had a quote outline that I want to, just need to find out on the internet. I'm doing it right now.
Question. People here read the Age of Revolution.
Not recently.
No, it's, okay, that's what I was pretty understanding. What people read.
Ben, the book where you only read the lecture, right?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Ben is, Ben's had not much time for reading. I wanted to do it, I had to, like, that would come to a few volumes done by the time we get to Preston.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was a really good, a lot of fun.
That one was slow going when I was reading.
Yeah.
Actually. Kind of funny. The house one was always slow going as reading. The Wilson is like very.
No, the Wilson's great.
The Age of Revolution is slower than
that. Oh, it is, okay. This one's a longer, isn't it?
You know, rereading it after reading like more specialized stuff, I was like more impressed by it from the first time.
Oh yeah, because the synthesis is very impressive.
It's very, it's very good. It's
yeah.
Very,
okay, are we going?
We're
shooting.
Our,
okay.
The recorder.
No, it's already.
This is already on. But how do I activate
press
this?
Record.
A red light's on.
Okay.
Okay. If that makes sense. So I'm just wrapping up some things from last time to begin the whole History of the Left series. And I realized that I went through very quickly at the end last time. So it's basically just a recap of the central points of that and then to set up Richard, who's going to be speaking about 1789 to 1848, the French Revolution to the outbreak of European-wide revolutions in the mid-19th century. And I just want to recap that we talked about the three high ideals of 18th and 19th century bourgeois civilization being peace, prosperity, and autonomy. It sounds a bit like George Herbert Walker Bush invading Kuwait during the first Gulf War, but in a, on a serious note, these were seriously the ideals enunciated. And of course, they mean much more than simply those words may be understood to be in a vulgar sense today. Peace being the removal of direct or overt coercion in a political or extra-economic fashion from social life. Prosperity being wealth accumulation, but ultimately the freeing up of labor, of men and women to pursue their own transformation of nature in the way they choose, which is really key because it means that a key category of bourgeois thought is the labor theory of value. In fact, it is the main category, I would argue, bourgeois thought, from which everything else, private property, freedom of competition, the parliamentary state, flows. So it's the central feature of the thought. And the third and final thing, autonomy, which is that given the removal of direct extra economic or political coercion from social life, the rise of prosperity, wealth accumulation, the freedom of labor, allowing for people to be removed from the barest drudgery and subsistence, the true field of self-activity, of self-determining freedom arises, where men and women set their own goals individually of their own lives and collectively together of their social lives. So again, autonomy, prosperity, peace as the central goals of bourgeois civilization. And it should be said that, as I recapped last time, although postmodern social theory, which reigns today, often has a tendency to be understood as a sort of 1970s on phenomenon, and Marxists generally approach it as a reflection of the transformation to a neoliberal economy after the world economic downturn starting in 1973, in particular Frederick Jameson, David Harvey, etc., that its real moment comes with the disillusionment of the Great War, the interwar economic depression, the rise of fascism, and the Second World War. And fascism has its explicit self-understanding, a revolt against 1789. In fact, Hitler all the time uses bourgeois as a derogatory term to describe an empty, meaningless life of chatter and consumption. So there's an essence in which fascism is, I would say, the first mass European movement that really portrays itself as totally antithetical to the high ideals of bourgeois civilization, prosperity, autonomy, peace, as sort of vulgar, materialistic, empty conceptions. But it has, but this is really the moment of postmodernity. That is the moment of what appears to be the total failure of those ideals to come into being, with mass war of the early 20th century, total devastation of European society, the rise of classic fascism, and the explicit idea of a revolt against the bourgeois revolutions. The Nazis consciously understood themselves as the revolutionaries against 1789. So basically, that, I would say, is the real moment of sort of postmodern disillusionment and the beginning of a lot of subsequent trends that come into their own after the 1970s and still flourish and thrive today. But that's neither here nor there. I wanted to go back to what we call the problem of the transition from feudalism to capitalism, which at its heart is the problem of a transition from one mode of living to another, one Dasein to another, if you will. And the problem is the traditional models that have been used to explain that, I'll call the Smithian and the traditional Marxist, which are deeply interconnected and impossible. This is only purely a thought form. I'm disentangling things which are two totally entwined things. The Smithian dynamic says when the market extends at any point in world history, people seek the gains from trade and specialize. That, therefore, extends the division of labor, different people specializing and producing different things for one another, which causes economic productivity. The traditional Marxist, or as enunciated in Engels, although he includes this as an element of it, sees the mastery of nature leading to the growth of productive forces since the beginning of the human species. That leads to the extension and division of labor, which leads to a division between mental and manual labor, which in turn produces, in a techno-functional sense, class relations, relations of production. That is, the relations of production simply occupy the state of the level of the growth of the productive forces and what's necessary for the growth of those productive forces, understood as simply a natural process once you have the human species. And those class relations give rise to the form of state. But in either of these models, as we can see, there's absolutely no need for a transition from one mode of life or one social organization to another. The mechanisms exist from the beginning throughout all of human history. There is no transition problem in this model, okay? And bourgeois revolution, which I'm going to be speaking about much more concretely and historically today, is really just a mechanistic notion. A simplistic notion in the traditional Marxist model, all you need it for is eventually the productive forces under feudalism reach a point where the division of labor, the division between mental and manual labor, and the relations of production, class relations, are no longer adequate to the productive forces. So the productive forces just burst through. But there's really no political moment. There's really no revolutionary moment because it doesn't introduce a new form of social life, because that form of social life has always existed. The mechanisms that have driven it always exist and continue to exist. And it doesn't at all, it's nothing more than a mechanistic necessity along the way of an inevitable trajectory. And same with the Smithian dynamic, right? And Smith and Engels both more or less will tell a very similar story when they start to look at medieval Europe. And it's really just unnecessary to have a bourgeois revolution in these models at all. Now, if you recall, what I tried to say was, although this informed the early Marx, particularly in the German ideology and to some degree in the Communist Manifesto, the later Marx, when he historically specifies the dynamic of social life, ever-changing social life to modernity itself, to capitalism itself, he therefore has a problem, which is he can no longer use that dynamic to explain the rise of that form of society itself. That is, he can no longer assume precisely what needs to be explained, that human social life has a dynamic towards ever-increasing change, ever-increasing productivity. So in doing that, I would insist that's why primitive accumulation is the last chapter of Capital, Volume 1. Because in the German ideology and the Communist Manifesto, what you do is you begin at the beginning of human history, the Neolithic Revolution, and then you move right up to capitalism, because capitalism is just quantitative change within a story of the development of the growth of productive forces, and they're coming into contradiction with relations of production, and they're bursting through them. So you need to begin at the beginning of human history and take it through, and then arrives capitalism, you describe it. But by Capital Volume 1, you describe capitalism as a historically specific form of social life rooted in certain definite, concrete social relations that then primitive accumulation necessarily comes at the end, because all you need to explain is the rise of this form of life. It's not a dynamic of development throughout of all of human history. So you put the primitive accumulation chapter, which has always been in the German ideology and the Communist Manifesto at the beginning, before you describe capitalism. You now put it at the end, because all you really need is to describe how the society that's historically specific emerged in the first place. And you can't assume precisely the mechanisms to explain its emergence that are the mechanisms that drive it itself, right? And I would say that this also restores to dignity the concept of bourgeois revolution. But let me suggest what this means. Rather, in the older model, the traditional Marxist and the Smithian models, bourgeois revolution is generally some force within feudalism itself or within pre-capitalism. Generally, merchants and manufacturers begin to rise up. They find the class society around them no longer satisfactory to their needs. They overthrow it, right? Now, I want to suggest that that's not the case, that under feudalism and pre-capitalism, there are no such actors that find social constraints and the need to carry out mass political revolutions to overturn the society they live in. I want to suggest rather that bourgeois revolutions are political transformations that can happen only after the rise of capitalist social relations, which are contingent and indeed accidental. And then bourgeois revolutions, I would argue, instead of being understood as the expression of a rising class coming up against the feudal system, destroying it and creating capitalist society, should instead be understood within the history of capitalism as a deepening and extension of the dynamics of capitalist society. And in the specific three revolutions I'm going to talk about today, the Dutch, the English, and the French revolutions, they should be understood as bourgeois or civil society overtaking the state and bringing the state within the sphere of civil society. That is, subsuming the state to bourgeois civilization itself. So again, once you change the model of the transition to capitalism, you necessarily change the model of bourgeois revolution. It's no longer usefully understood as some kind of bourgeois forces slumbering in feudalism that slowly grow up, break asunder, and transform the whole world into capitalism. It's rather the decline and devastation of feudalism, which then self-transforms to a new form of society, capitalist. And bourgeois revolution should be understood as the bourgeois civil society arising out of those capitalist social revolutions, seeking to extend and deepen those social relations by incorporating the territorial absolutist state to its own dynamics. Sorry, Chris, did you have a question?
Just I wanted to underline something, which is you talk about restoring the dignity of the bourgeois revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Another way of putting it is the necessity of the bourgeois revolution in order to bring about what we understand as modern capitalism. In other words, without these bourgeois revolutions, without a political change, that in a sense the bourgeois revolutions are bound up with the emergence of modern capitalism. And that what we call capitalism prior to the bourgeois revolution is sort of proto-capitalism rather than capitalism in the way that Marx understands it.
Right, in the sense of real subsumption.
Or even formal subsumption, frankly, because I think that, I don't even think that trade, you know, like the market and private property, and I don't think those would have been adequate categories even for formal subsumption. But anyway,
right.
You need like manufacturing.
No, you need manufacturing.
Right.
Although they may have been adequate categories to bring about the divorce of peasants from the land, so to speak. No, I agree with that. So moving on now to the specificity, just to cover very quickly, to recap last time about transition feudalism to capitalism. So the point here is this, is basically the key thing to understand about all pre-capitalism is that peasants remain in the control of means of production, means of subsistence. And the vast majority, 99% of human species on the planet are in fact peasants, indirect control. And they produce immediately for their own consumption. And there's absolutely no need, or they see no need to follow the Smithian dynamic, following the extension of the market of gains from trade, specialization, extension, division, labor, economic productivity, because they produce immediately for themselves everything they need in life. and there's nothing they're going to capture from the market or from specializing, et cetera, et cetera. Now, let me just say something, which is this rather, that is, basically, we can see a Malthusian pattern in the feudal economy that I talked about last time, and I don't want to use that in the sense of like Thomas Malthus and his own understanding of the dynamics of modernity, but just in a simple economistic sense of, basically, what happens under feudalism is, since peasants are directly in control of the means of subsistence, lords, in order to reproduce themselves and to get their material resources, have to use extra economic coercion, political coercion, violence, to extract a surplus from the peasants themselves. Because the peasants are controlled the means of production and subsistence, the peasants produce a set amount of good, the lords force them to give them a portion of those goods. Okay? Now, what happens in the feudal economy is basically the only way you can really extend the feudal economy is colonization. That is, moving settler agriculturalists further, deeper, either north, east, south, or west from your lands. There's finite resources. The only way you can acquire more resources is literally to move, to occupy more land, to have more peasants working on more land.
Or conquest.
Both conquest and colonization. Although conquest, in a sense, necessarily revolves the redivision of something that already exists, whereas colonization is the one thing that lets you extend to something that doesn't exist beforehand. Richard, I'm going to take questions later. So the key is, during the Q&A, so the key is on this is that basically phase A, what I want to say is phase A of the feudal economy from 1000 to 1300. Basically, what this is characterized by is the growth of peasant populations in the mean of production, where peasants produce, they subdivide their holdings to their sons that are born, and they subdivide them. And basically, they continuously subdivide, and you get continuous population growth through phase A. And we see population rise straight up from 1,000 to 1,300. This involves peasants working on their means of production, having kids, giving each of the sons a subholding, which in turn produces more for himself and a more family, and increases. And what you see is the growth of population. Now, the problem is, as this happens and peasants redivide the means of subsistence, there's a tendency to decrease and have ever smaller holdings, which means you have weaker land-labor ratios. That is, although you have more total being produced from the land, you actually, because you don't have the efficiency that comes with larger estates, you have smaller estates, you're getting less produced total at the societal level. So basically what happens here with less produced total at the societal level is population is running up how much can be produced in agriculture itself. So again, population is expanding exponentially. Resources to feed that population are expanding arithmetically. So what's happening is you basically are running up against limits on how you can feed your own population and produce the form of life you have. And this drives a process of colonization, which means you send peasants and lords out to colonize wastelands, swamps that haven't previously been settled. And what that essentially does is brings in more land under cultivation, allows for more total output to be produced. But you're increasingly going on worse and worse lands. And this is not modern agrarian equipment being applied to these lands. So you're on worse and worse lands, getting less and less production. So feudalism basically leads to a crisis phase, which is not to be understood. This is all anachronistic. Not to be understood as a crisis in the modern sense at all. But feudalism basically leads to a phase B, a so-called phase B. In phase B, what essentially happens is that you have, so within phase A, you have the move from population increase running up against the finite amount of resources that can feed the population, leading to a crisis period where you get basically peasant revolts. Peasant revolts because basically peasants don't want to give lords more. When lords start demanding more from the peasants, peasants don't want to give lords more, they revolt. The lords demand more because they demand ever-increasing resources, but the amount of resources the peasants able to produce are running up against definite limits. So the lords, therefore, try and either lock their peasants into place or begin launching warfare against one another to acquire more peasants, more tenants, more farm territory with which to reproduce themselves. And this leads to interlordly competition and basically warfare between lords and warfare between lords and peasants. And also you get plagues because when population is closer to starvation, disease spreads more quickly. This is a fact of human history. Disease spreads. So probably the Black Plague or similar symptoms of it had come before Europe before, but if they come to an upswing of the feudal economy, they'd have far less devastating effect. So what happens between 1,000 and 1,300 is you have the growth of population, but it's running up by 1,300 against resources. This unsets a crisis phase where you get peasant, where you get lords fighting with one another to try and coerce more peasants. You get the Hundred Years' War, the great struggle between the English and the French nobilities. You get the peasant revolts, the Jacqueries in France, the great peasant revolts in England, the peasant cults across German-speaking Central Europe. Famously, you get this in 1517, during or shortly after Luther and the Protestant Reformation, and he insists on putting it down. But that's neither here nor there. So this crisis phase, and also you get the Black Plague. And so a phase A is followed by phase B, where war and starvation and disease reduce the population to such a degree that you can allow a new period of growth to ensue, right? That is 1300, huge crisis, 1400, which I don't have marked, crisis, 1450 about, crisis starts to restore itself, and you get the same dynamic from 1,000 to 1,300, now going from 1,300 to 1,700. You get the same dynamic, a phase A of running up against definite resources, producing war, crisis, famine, disease, a phase B, the elimination of population, and therefore many more resources than the population that exists, and this allows the growth, the return to a growth of feudalism. Now the key is, feudalism could have kept on going on this way forever. There's no natural tendency to a new society. Feudalism can keep going on this pattern forever. There's no dynamic emerging. Now people have traditionally seen the towns and burgher life within them as a kind of proto-modernity or coming of a bourgeois order. And this is just, I can't stress it enough, this is terribly wrong. Terribly wrong for two reasons, because you can only really have bourgeois subjectivity when you have the mass commodification of labor power, which you do not have in any phase of the feudal development of the economy. The rise of towns is rather linked to this. In phase A, which is the growth, right? I mean, growth and then setting into crisis. In phase A, during growth, you get more settled agriculture by more peasants producing more food, meaning people can afford to go off the land. The people who go off the land end up producing good within guilds, frameworks of guilds, both merchants and manufacturers end up producing luxury goods for those feudal lords. Luxury goods and military goods, means of violence with which the lords can coerce the peasants and extract a surplus, means of public representativeness which lords can show their character, their estate, their caste basis, fine textiles, wine, et cetera, paintings, et cetera, violins, et cetera, and basically the towns therefore receive a surplus of grain extracted extra-economically by the lords. That's how they subsist. In return, they produce for this limited market of the lords, right? And there's nothing in this economy. Everybody is organized overtly and politically. Guilds, merchant companies, feudal aristocratic lords, peasant village communities, everyone is organized overtly and politically, and there's nothing in this economy that is all opposed to the feudal order is constrained by it. So from 1,000 to 1,300, you experience the renaissance of the so-called 12th century, which is the rise of towns, but towns arise because you're in a good phase of the medieval economy, more people can go off the land, the lords are doing better because they have a bigger extra-economic surplus, so they can buy more luxury and military goods, there's more people to produce for them. And then you see the decline of towns after 1,300, because, and again, this is not, you have the decline, they're not on the rise. In the feudal crisis, they're not on the rise, they're on the decline, because basically in the feudal crisis, when population runs up against resources, what happens is basically people no longer have the agrarian surplus that they can pay out to the town. Lords and peasants no longer have that to pay out to the town to get their goods back from the town, and towns go in decline. And artisans and manufacturers and merchants, rather than being on the rise and struggling against feudal economy, end up going on the decline. They end up entering a phase of decline, and because they can no longer produce the non-agrarian goods that feed the lordly communities, luxury and military products. So they enter into a phase of decline. Now, phase B on the return, yeah.
Let me interrupt.
Yeah.
Phase A and B then are not chronologically located, but they are actually...
Sorry, within each other.
Part of a cycle that repeats twice.
Yes, 1,000 to 1,300, 1,300 to 1,700.
It's confusing.
And within phase A, again, it's the upcline, which then meets a limit and causes crisis. And phase B is the continuation of the crisis, but through disease, plague, famine, starvation, war, interlordly competition, the restoration of the growth. right? Ben, sorry, Ben. Richard, we'll do Q&A. Yeah, no, go ahead.
Okay, one of the things that should be mentioned about phase A is in Europe was covered with huge forests, and a medieval historian did give an analysis.
Yes, when they're cultivating the land, they reproduce forests.
Europe in the 10th century, he said, a squirrel could go from Paris to Moscow, never set foot on the ground because it could hop from tree to tree. And there's a massive clearing of forest and colonization of wasteland, so that the European landscape is transformed in that period, which is what accounts for the growth of population. And the population reaches a peak of around 1320. And the population of most of Europe around 1300 was higher than that until the end of the 16th century. So for several hundred years, most of Europe had lower populations than it did in the 13th century.
That's
just underlying what James is saying.
That's right.
I'm just wondering about the kind of way the cycle goes on. You're saying that by the beginning of the 15th century, the end of phase A, that the crisis is manifested in terms of peasant revolts?
Peasant revolts, black plague, interlordly competition, 100 years war between
then,
lords.
Okay, but phase B starts with the peasant revolts and the death and disease and war.
Yes, well, phase A leads to the beginning of the crisis, and the crisis is a kind of in-between period, and phase B is the restoration, meaning the crisis sloughs off so much of the population, you get a restoration of the upswing of the feudal economy. And what Richard said is right. As you run up against these limits, they begin to colonize additional lands. And what needs to be understood is this is why you get the push east of the Elbe of European Christendom. You get the push east of the Elbe. You get the reclamation of lands near the Baltics and in Scandinavia. And yes, even the so-called highly modern process of the discovery of the New World is a process within the feudal economy. That is, it's caught up with the Reconquista, which is caught up with, again, settling new peasant agriculturalists against Islamic Spain, restoring it, and then extending them to the New World. And the initial Spanish occupation of the New World follows a classic feudal pattern of setting up agricultural settlers, of course, coercing the indigenous population in this case. But it's important to realize they're also coercing the indigenous populations. They're moving up the Elbe. We just think of Elbe as Europe, and the New World is non-Europe. So somehow it appears different to us. But within the 15th century, it's a very similar process of coercing the same amount of people into feudal estates, settled agriculture, so you can get them to produce, and then you can extract a part of that surplus to produce. Right?
They actually compared the Indians with the Moors initially. They thought it was the same. But I think what is interesting about how the cycle works is the fact that here, in order for in the feudal economy, in order for the economy to recycle, to begin growing again, it needs a lot of people to die, actually.
Yes, right? Absolutely. Absolutely. It needs their mutual immiseration.
How's the population of Europe?
30, in the 14th century, 30 to 40% of the population of the 13th century is not there in Western Europe. So by 1360, 1370, you have a population of Western Europe that is a third less than it was 100 years ago. So that's quite extraordinary due to black plague, interlordly competition, feudal warfare, peasant revolts, famine, starvation, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the towns rise and grow with this movement. They're totally interconnected to it. When you reach a surplus limit on the countryside, that's the less you can produce to give to the towns. The people have to devote all their time producing for agricultural life because you're running out of agricultural resources, food, the things you need to live. Therefore, you can spend less money on town goods, and the towns decline. Right, and so they're totally part of this movement, and this is why you see the Italian city-states, this beautiful flourishing of commercial and financial life in the heart of medieval Europe, really go on the decline, and they're non-entities by the late 16th, early 17th century. Now, the point here is this: is so then you also have this dynamic of interlordly competition, which leads to ever greater states, like I had last time, with bits of patchwork leading to ever larger states. If you remember that. And that was interlordly competition. They're growing up on an increasing scale. Lords are combining and recombining into princely states in order, but it's not modernity. They want to extra economically extract a surplus from the peasantry on an ever higher level, right? So this is the creation of a centralized territorial state that wants to extract extra economically what the feudal lord used to be doing locally, the absolutist monarch is now doing on the national level. Right? This is within, this is the 14th, 15th century. Now, I want to go to the point now of bourgeois revolutions, which is, basically, As a key here, I want to say that I want to do mute, Chris, right? Pick mute.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the map of Europe circa 1430, right? This is now, you've had the crisis of the 14th century, you're beginning a return to the upswing, and you have the consolidation. This would have been in 10,000 many, many little places, ruled by very tiny lordly communities. You have increasing consolidation into these lordly communities, right? Into these lordly communities, and what happens is they're territorial states that are on an ever big level, because basically lords have combined and recombined in the Richard Nutnow, in the face of peasant resistance, lords have combined and recombined to extract an extra economic surplus from peasants directly with control of means of production. But key here is that in two regions, right? Two regions, which is approximately here within the Duke of Burgundy's land in this dark maroon area, particularly here and here, you have something very unusual in the 14th century when peasants and lords are now fighting, when producers and appropriators, I won't call it class struggle, are now waging war during the crisis. When the resources run up against their limit, the peasants and the lords are waging war with one another, right? And there's a very peculiar solution in this area, the Duke of Burgundy's lands. What is the Duke of Burgundy's lands are the Low Countries, today's Luxembourg, Belgium, Netherlands, northern France, and southern British Isles, southeastern England. There's a very peculiar solution, which is, I'll describe it very quickly in each case. In the southeastern British Isles, what happens is peasants are dispossessed from the means of production, peasants get the end of serfdom. During this crisis of the 14th century, remember, peasants don't want to pay the heavier dues because lords, because they have less resources, are demanding more of them. Peasants revolt. They escape from serfdom, okay? Now, what the lords do is the lords invite the peasants to come back and work the land, but they're not doing this in a capitalist manner. It's not commercial agriculture. They have no option left to them. That serfdom has ended. So they're asking them to come back, but they're still working within the feudal mode that essentially these guys are coming back onto the land and working for them in the old feudal manner. Peasants are coming back onto the land with the idea in their head that we're going to have proprietary rights in this land. This is going to be our piece of land. We're going to own the means of production, means of subsistence. I'm being anachronistic here. So they're both working as feudal actors, right? Serfdom is ended. The lords have basically only their lands. They can no longer coerce people to work for them. They need people to use their lands. So they invite the peasants back as commercial tenants. As tenants. And the key here is the peasants come back as tenants, but the peasants think they're coming back into control of the land, and the lords think that they're still in control of the land, even though their ability to extra-economically coerce them is lost, right? Now, as this starts to happen, you get a dynamic, basically, where peasants are coming back, they're being hired by the lords, hired, so to speak, and then the peasants try and reassert their right of ownership, their right of ownership over the lands that they've been leased. And the lords, not in any sort of capitalist manner, but a perfect feudal manner, assert their feudal privileges, which is they control this land, the peasants don't control this land, and both actors, in asserting their feudal privileges, what ends up coming about is the peasants are dispossessed of means of production, the lords are dispossessed of serfdom, and you have the rise of basically an agrarian capitalism. That is, the aristocratic lord hires out to capitalist tenant farmers, who are larger peasants, who then employ smaller peasants as agrarian wage laborers. And this sets them all in competition with one another and totally dependent on the market for their inputs and outputs for reproduction. So what happens is you have the rise of capitalist agriculture. And this brings about an immense increase in productivity and an immense cheapening of food prices because of efficiency and growth of productivity. Basically, there's much more food being produced at a much cheaper cost, and many more people have disposable income. They can spend a larger proportion of their income on non-agricultural necessities. This leads to the peasants that have been expropriated going to new towns beyond guild restrictions and setting up capitalist manufacture, right? Again, it's not manufacturers who have imagined this. Right? It's not that someone imagined this in the feudal order and brought it about, or sought to brought it about. You have the self-transformation of feudalism. This dumps a bunch of people off of the land. The land is now operating in a capitalist agrarian manner, And basically, these people can now go into work and produce mass goods for the whole population, because now no one is producing for their own consumption, and everyone has cheap food prices and very affordable food consumption, so they can afford to spend more on manufacturers. And you really, by the end of the 17th century in England, you have a mass market. You really have the production of goods that are not designed as under feudalism for a lordly few as luxuries, but are rather a mass market for everyone, right? And this, yes, Pablo.
Could you tell us an author that describes that process?
This is very well described by three authors. One would be Robert Brenner in his famous article on agrarian change and economic development in pre-industrial Europe. And another one would be, who describes it very well, is a guy named E.L. Jones, and I forget the name of the book, who's essentially a liberal historian. And another one would be Lawrence Stone. E.L. Jones. I don't remember his book. And then Lawrence Stone, a famous liberal British historian, writes a book called The Crisis of the Aristocracy. Now, so this produces an accidental form in southeastern England where people are divorced from the means of production. Okay? And all lords have are their land. The only thing they can do to reproduce themselves is invite peasants back on contractually to work on the lands themselves. This sets up a competitive process leading to increases in food productivity, cheapening of food prices, sloughs ever more people off the land as lords want to keep grabbing land. And when the lords initially grab land, they use their feudal rights to do it, right? So they're claiming private property, but they're not sort of consciously doing it from a modern definitional sense of private property. This is sloughing ever more people off the land, and they find a home eventually in urban manufacturing and commerce, which are now being directed in a capitalist manner. And you have the end of peasant control of the means of subsistence and the rise of the mass of the population as labor power, right? To be bought and sold contractually on the market, et cetera, et cetera. Now, in the Netherlands, you have a different resumption. What happens is peasant agrarians are sent by their lords to go colonize in the 14th century because this is all marsh and swampland that no one's inhabiting. And as resources are running up against their limits, they set the peasants and the lords up here to colonize. Well, peasants by themselves to colonize, to reclaim the swamps and the marshes to produce classic feudal agriculture. Now, this makes, because of this process, lordship is extremely weak here, extremely weak. And what happens is peasants get direct ownership of the means of production, their own land. So, but this isn't the end of feudalism, of course, because peasants have required the means of production. But there are recurrent ecological disasters that cause large swaths of the land to be reclaimed by the water. This, to this day, is still a threat in the Netherlands. They have dikes, they have dams that prevent the overclimbing of the water. And this basically divorces the peasants that have settled the land from their means of production. And they end up cooperating with one another and more or less becoming market dependent for their inputs and outputs. And then you see a process of specialization following. So these two totally accidental contingent resolutions to a 14th century crisis, okay, within the terms of the feudal economy itself, not some kind of rise in capitalism, are such that labor power becomes a commodity in both areas for an accidental ecological invasion and an accidental resolution to a struggle between expropriators and producers, which arrives at labor power as a commodity in these two regions overwhelmingly. Now, what's important is this shouldn't be understood as the Netherlands and England in the 14th century. That's really a horrible way to understand it. It's sections of the overall integrated medieval feudal economy that experience this, right? England and Netherlands are national terms that come to contain these lands later, but they're not at this moment. I mean, of course, this is the Kingdom of England. Of course, this is the regions of the Duke of Burgundy.
I'll go ahead and we'll come back later.
It actually underlines
another question. When you look at this map, you have to realize this is an anachronistic map because it's reproducing, for visual reasons, a much later state form that doesn't exist at this time. So there's like the blue areas, it's like England or France, or like the territories of the Duke of Burgundy. The Duke of Burgundy owned lands both that were feudal domains of the Kingdom of France and in the Holy Roman Empire. And his domains fell apart after 1477. But one of the things that it shows is the contingency of later nation states. So that this is a period before nation states, and these maps where we have these areas represent many different types of
Absolutely.
Social and political orders. So that you have to look at this map and realize that it's anachronistic. It's projecting a type of social order that developed much later back onto this period.
Absolutely. Now, coming out of the 14th century, coming into phase...
I think it's also important to say that in any case, the kingdom is very different from a modern state. In the
yes.
sense that it doesn't have schools or it doesn't collect taxes in the way that it's being collected now. It doesn't have a national army.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's right. Okay, that's right. Guys, but if unless it's a clarificatory question, like you don't understand anything, just let's, because we need to rush through here. So the point here, examples can be multiplied in the Q&A limitlessly. Okay, so the point here is key, that this is the 14th century, this is the end of phase A, the crisis arises, peculiar resolutions to the crisis, here and here, bring on the mass dispossession of the peasantry in those regions, which means you have labor power as a commodity en masse in a way that you've never had before. Now, key, phase B begins, the regrowth of the feudal economy because of the devastation by the 15th century of all of Europe. You can have the regrowth. You have many more resources now than you have population. You get the onset of a new phase A, which is growth that will once again eventually reach its limit and bring about crisis. But what's key is during this phase B, during the regrowth from the 14th century to the 17th century, you have two different processes going on under the same cover. That is, what's going on is you're getting interlordly communities across Europe regrouping with one another to become ever larger territorial absolute states to extract a surplus extra economically for the peasants and control the means of production. But while that's definitely going on, in certain regions, while on the ground, it's definitely still feudalism. It's still peasants and the means of subsistence. It's actually become, in other areas, capitalist agriculture, giving rise to capitalist towns and capitalist manufacturing commerce within those towns, where the kings still increasingly seek extra economically to extract a surplus. So again, across Western Europe, Central Europe, lordly communities have grown into ever more centralized, feudal, territorial, absolute states to extract extra economically a surplus. In some regions, they're actually doing it. In the vast majority, 80% of Europe, they're doing it from where peasants are actually in control of the means of production. In two very unique regions, the Netherlands and England, during the 15th and 16th centuries, they're doing it in areas where you no longer have peasants in control of the means of production, and you have increasingly labor and its products becoming a self-mediating activity, right? It's in these two regions where en masse, labor and its products, no one is producing for their own consumption, everyone is now socially independent and linked into with the labor of others, and labor and its products are becoming a self-mediating activity. They're not being mediated. Production is not being mediated explicitly by overt political organization, hierarchies, kinship, any type of anthropological concepts that are applicable to pre-modernity. Now, I need to really rush to this. What happens is the first major, so you have these consolidation, these feudal absolutist states on an ever more centralized level, their lords regrouping under kings to extra economically extract a surplus during this phase B, the devastation of the population and the regrowth from 1300 to 1700. But in certain regions, they're doing it from what we can call capitalist social relations. In certain regions, they're doing it from feudal social relations. Now, what's really important is the first bourgeois revolution that arises on the horizon, right, is the Dutch Revolt, which breaks out in 1568. And lasts. It's known as the 80 Years' War because it lasts until 1648. Now, the Netherlands is actually begins the period 1568, and I want to show you a map here. It's very important, very quickly, just because I know it's confusing about it. The Low Countries were generally a region of northern France, Luxembourg, Belgium, the Netherlands, that basically was in between the Holy Roman Empire and the Kingdom of France, had belonged to the Dukes of Burgundy, and are increasingly consolidated into one area, the Netherlands, controlled, and here they are, circa 1477, right? And this is basically modern Belgium and the Netherlands today. And basically what I want to say is this. Now, this area, okay, now this is a map of the Habsburg Empire in the 1590s, basically during the Dutch Revolt. Now, what's key about this is that the Habsburg Empire was a feudal, lordly community building up on an ever greater scale to form a dynastic absolutist state that extra economically extracted resources from peasants and controlled the means of production. And through dynastic marriage and interlordly competition and warfare and conquest, basically, by the 1590s, this is the Spanish branch of the Habsburg family. They have two branches, the Austrian and the Spanish. They're united briefly under Charles V in the mid-16th century. They become disunited by the end of the 16th century, and Philip II, Charles V's son, is the king of Spain and ruler of the Spanish Habsburg branch. And the Spanish Habsburg branch is today's Naples, southern Italy, Spain, Portugal, a small section of France, a small section of German-speaking Europe, Switzerland, and the Low Countries, right? But this is within this state form, which rose out of feudalism, this absolutist territorial state form, these people are largely, okay, peasants in control of the means of production that you are coercing extra economically, right? Now, this kingdom is in competition with a lot of other kingdoms like it. And increasingly greater competition, because in the 16th century, this interlordly competition gets a new dynamic, a twofold new dynamic, which is really important. One, military revolution. Military revolution happens because you have the invention of gunpowder, and suddenly the medieval cavalry are purposeless, right? Peasants can hold a gun and shoot you down, right? This is a death knell to the feudal order. You also get more sophisticated bows, et cetera, et cetera. And what this brings into being is now as a king, as the absolutist king coming out of the feudal order, you need a huge standing army. That is people wielding guns that march, and they take long times to invade areas. That is, as feudal states are getting bigger and more centralized, warfare is becoming a much more costly process. And you're getting increasing military inventions in warfare, because feudalism did have some technological development. We shouldn't mystify it as just totally static site. It had technological development. It's the key points of its technological development were mechanisms of coercion, where lords and princes could coerce peasants out of a surplus. And this increases things increasingly. And you get, basically, these feudal absolutist states, like the Habsburg monarchy, need huge standing armies, they need huge fiscal military states, complicated bureaucracies, to extract peasants and taxes and an extra economic surplus from their peasants, right? And they're in competition with other states. And this interstate competition, not in the modern sense of state, by the way, this interstate competition is essentially driving a process where these guys need ever greater tax resources from their domestic populations, meaning ever greater standing armies and means of coercion that they can use to go to the peasants locally. Like we were talking about peasant farmers last week. You show up, peasant farmers or tax farmers show up and coerce directly from the peasants who are in control of the means of production a portion of their products to take back to the king. And this dynamic of inter-feudal, inter-lordly competition on now an absolute estate basis requires ever greater extraction for the peasants of ever greater resources. And they try and lock these lands into that, right? That is, the king of Spain, Philip II, tries to lock the Netherlands into ever greater extractive commitments, okay? Taxes from that population. And basically, the population refuses. Okay, and they do so on the basis of the, everybody thinks this is an American revolutionary slogan. It's not. It's more or less the fundamental slogan of the bourgeois revolutions, which is no taxation without representation. That is, the Netherlands demand a level of input, especially the local elite, politically, that they are contributing economically. And what happens is this drives a process where eventually Philip II sends a very nasty character named the Duke of Alba there to basically, with the Catholic Church and with the feudal knighthood now in employ of Philip II, to coerce directly from the Dutch, okay? But this has already undergone a 200-year process, okay, where you now have the rise of basically a bourgeois society. The state is separate from civil society. Labor and its products are a self-mediating activity. People are interdependent on one another and are reproducing themselves without direct feudal coercion, in which that's increasingly been removed from life. And when Philip II tries to reinstitute this manner of coercion, you basically get the outbreak of the Dutch Revolt from 1568 to 1648. So the Netherlands initially start as part of the Habsburg Empire, but they don't revolt in the name of the Dutch nation. They revolt as basically a province of the Habsburg Empire that is upset at the way they're being treated by the center and are demanding a downput to this extra economic coercive activity, arbitrary power. Arbitrary power here understood as the state doing something that intervenes in the normal, law-like, rational functioning of civil society, which is based, as we know, on labor as a self-mediating activity. Now, the point here is that the Dutch revolt breaks out, and this causes a real problem. By 1608, the Netherlands is essentially an independent country. But it's really not until the Treaty of Westphalia is signed at the end of the Thirty Years' War in 1648 that everyone recognizes the Netherlands. And this is a real revolution in the affairs of European sovereignty, because now a republic determined by the...
split.
What?
Yes,
I'm sorry, the Netherlands becomes split, and it doesn't become Belgium until the 19th century, but it's the Spanish Netherlands throughout the 17th, the 18th century, and the Northern Netherlands, which are the united, which basically, the Habsburg Netherlands are 17 provinces. These are 17 provinces. The Northern seven break away. The whole 17 revolt. The seven manage the breakaway, okay, and become today the state of the Netherlands. And they continue to this day, the modern state of the Netherlands. So this essentially happens. You get this revolt, okay? And what's key is, let me just show you a picture. What's key is, so here's the map again. You get a better sense. It's really from East Friesland to Holland. Holland, by the way, is often used as a shorthand for the Netherlands. Holland is the most populous, rich, and most politically influential province within the seven provinces that are the Netherlands. So Holland is the key province within the seven provinces that are the Netherlands. They revolt, they're successful, they become independent. 1648, this is recognized. And this really scares the kings of Europe because you have a self-determining republican polity that is now recognized within the sovereign nation state system. But I want to show you something. At the beginning of this period, when you get basically the Habsburg absolute state attempting to assert over the Netherlands an extra economic levy, sending the Duke of Alba and using military coercion to try and extract revenue from its civil society, which provokes the Dutch revolt. And the Dutch, of course, understand their revolt in classic bourgeois terms of this is arbitrary influence in the free development of civil society. This is unnatural, opposed to the natural order. This is a destruction of what they see as the instantiation of reason that has been achieved in their capitalist society, okay? And this is Philip II at the beginning of this period in the classic way that these absolutist monarchers do it, dressing up in classic feudal knight attire, because of course they've long since lost their feudal status as actually going out and fighting in armies and beating up people and having to go and coerce peasants directly. And it's a kind of conscious reclamation, but in this is a public representativeness. You know Philip II from what he's wearing. You know Philip II from his knightly armor, et cetera, et cetera. But this was considered the picture of Habsburg sovereignty in the 1560s and 70s when the Dutch revolt breaks out, 1580s and 90s during the Dutch revolt going on. This is how the Habsburg Spanish branch line represented sovereignty, a picture of the king's physical body, right? Now, in the aftermath of the Dutch revolt, which ends in 1648 when all the powers of Europe recognize the Netherlands, they take a picture of the leading citizens of Amsterdam, basically more or less who have signed the treaty. Sorry, this is that picture of this band. Now, here is, again, where the Netherlands is independently. 1608, it achieved that in reality. 1648, all the powers of Europe recognize it. And then to celebrate that signing, you get by Bartholomeus van der Helst, this is the leading Amsterdam citizens in 1648 celebrating the approval of the Treaty of Westphalia, right? And there's a real sensibility in Dutch painting of the time of domestic life, of bourgeois domesticity, of the sense that not a hierarchical pre-given order, but people come together in public through their own reason and their own interaction, demanding the removal of the Habsburg arbitrary monarchy from their civil society, and the self-motivating activity of civil society, that is, independent individuals who now understand themselves to have subjective individual consciousness, coming together as a collectivity of equals to overturn a hierarchical order which they view as an arbitrary violation of their subjective conscious, of the order of natural law and reason, and of what should be the natural objective world. And you get this idea, this great sensibility of just these regular pictures of merchants and manufacturers enjoying little things of daily life, ships coming in, ships going out, the purchase of coffee, but a real sensibility in which the revolt was about the preservation of this kind of non-coercive sphere of civil society, being able to self-determine itself against the state. And of course, the system that is set up, the Estates General, in which all of the seven provinces send representatives, and they're the main legislative body that determines the Netherlands, there's a real sense there in which civil society, in their understanding, has overtaken the state. Right? That is, the state was previously above the law, above reason, above the collectivity of subjective individual consciousness come together to determine what the natural order is and how best to institute it. They have overtaken it, and they have instituted a representative assembly in the sense that all of their seven provinces send to a main Estates General that rules over all the Netherlands representatives. And this is the first great bourgeois revolution. And it starts out with a kind of Calvinist language, but by the end of it, you have the full-blown language of political economy. Pierre Delacour is hired by Jan de Witt, the leading Dutch Republican, to publish a treatise that essentially gets widespread throughout all of Europe in the 1650s and 60s, in which he basically says freedom of trade and representative government are more or less the natural order of things. And we've accepted 1,000 years of darkly night feudal barbarism to override this. Right? Et cetera, et cetera. And it's now the responsibility of Europe to overturn it. And kings are really afraid once they recognize the Netherlands. Everyone is really deeply afraid of this, and you even get plotting to try and overturn it, et cetera, et cetera. Now, at the same time, in that other region that I pointed out to earlier of Europe, here, England, at the same time that you're getting this process, what's happening is the Stuart monarchy of the early 17th century, who has to respond to this growing absolutist state dynamic of competition militarily, needs to start building a standing army. And then also starts to extra economically try and coerce taxes from the population without any kind of reference to their legislative assemblies, the parliament, right? So again, what you have is in the same situation, the Stuarts feel that they're weak, they're not important within the courts of Europe, that they have essentially a feudal state apparatus, they want this big bureaucratic military state that their Habsburg and Valois rivals have, and Bourbon rivals, and they want it now, and this means that they have to build a standing army, they have to have an absolutist monarchy that unites the entire realm, and they require, therefore, a surplus with which to do it, and they begin demanding with their own divine rights said surplus from the population. And in response to this, you get a revolt. That is, a revolt initially of the aristocratic parliament, and then it becomes a mass-based revolt later on in the English Civil Wars, which is, again, essentially around these issues in which the claim is that only the people can tax themselves. That is, only popular consent can submit to the taxation themselves, which gives them some degree of control and policy. But basically, this ultimately winds up in the middle, I'm sorry, I can't enlarge this anymore. In the middle of the 17th century, 1649, with the killing of Charles I. Because what happens, Charles I, in response to this absolutist territorial state dynamic of needing ever means of larger means of coercion, begins to make more demands via taxes of their population economically. But again, in England, like in the Netherlands, since the 14th century, you've got the commodification of labor power and the rise of a bourgeois civil society. And, sorry? Oh, thank you. The rise of a bourgeois civil society. Will that now go in between them all?
No, you just have to hit escape.
Escape, okay.
I'll do it for
a minute. Okay. The rise of a bourgeois society. And basically, the king tries to construct an absolutist state apparatus on the continental model to rule independently of any reference to the population to extra economically extract a surplus. And what happens is you get a revolt, initially of the aristocratic lords in parliament, but because the state has a monopoly of the means of violence, they call on popular mobilization. You get the increasing radicalization of the English Civil Wars, which results in the beheading of the king. And ultimately, this eventually leads to a process of breakdown and chaos itself. I won't go into it. Richard did some of it in the first lecture. And this eventually will lead to a restoration of the Stuart monarchy. Basically, a restoration of the Stuart monarchy, which will more or less lead to the same problem. Nothing was resolved after the English Civil Wars. Again, the Stuarts, who are the kings, want, like their continental competitors, they want the full-blown absolutist state apparatus with the standing army, the military means, and they begin to try and get it extra economically through coercion. And again, the parliamentary classes and plebeian lower orders rise up as a whole as a third estate against this system and launch a revolution. Against this system, which basically is opposed to James II. You see James here trying to picture himself. It's funny because you really have During the you have James II trying to picture himself like his continental lords as this great feudal lord in knightly levy, ruling over men, master of dominions, having arbitrary absolute authority. And he more or less tries to portray himself as the representative of the sovereignty of England, the physical embodiment of it from which law flows from God to himself to the population at large. And you get the Glorious Revolution. Now, the Glorious Revolution is, again, like the Civil Wars, right? This is an attempt to overthrow the king. But this time, really, first off, capitalist relations are developed much further by the end of the 17th century. So most of the population, bourgeois civil society is so deepened and strengthened that most of the population wants to get rid of James II. He really is doing a very late project of trying to construct this territorial absolutism. And overnight, his armies won't fight for him. His entire state order abandons him and goes over to William III, who's a Dutch king that's invading. But he's invading at the request of English lords and clerics and merchants. And he's coming in, and he's essentially, and this is really the picture of the Glorious Revolution, the ultimate picture of the Glorious Revolution. This is Mary and William. They are the Dutch stadtholder. And they've invaded at the request of English noblemen and merchants and manufacturers and clerics. She's James II's daughter. They invite them over to invade and take the throne. Now, what's key is they maintain a constitutional monarchy and don't establish a republic like the Dutch, because this guy's meaningless. William is the stadtholder of the Netherlands, but he's pointless. He's figurehead of the Netherlands. But he comes over and invades, and what happens at the request of the English, and then they elect their monarchy. They give him the crown. Right, they give William the crown, and William and Mary become the co-holders of the crown in 1688. That is the Glorious Revolution. And the key and main theorist of the Glorious Revolution is Locke, John Locke, the liberal theorist. He writes his treatise in the 1680s. He's plotting all the time against Charles II, who's the king before James II. In 1683, his boss, the Earl of Shaftesbury, is killed as a Whig or Republican or radical plotter against the monarchy. Locke flees and lives in the Netherlands, which is the site of all revolutionary activity. All revolutionary and radical exiles and theorists are in the Netherlands hanging out at this point, in the coffee shops of Amsterdam, in Rotterdam, hanging out, discussing activities, talking about everything from Spinoza's political theory and metaphysics to the nature of overthrowing monarchies and the necessity of doing so. And John Locke basically writes a tract called The Second Treatise on Government, which is meant to be the revolutionary justification. It's written before the Glorious Revolution. It's meant to be the revolutionary justification of it, and it only comes out afterward. And Locke comes after the Glorious Revolution and joins the new regime. But what Locke says is that property adheres when man transforms nature with his labor. So man's labor transforms nature and creates property. And that all of civil society is founded on the mutual respect of property or the creation of labor for one another. And that the king is essentially declaring war on civil society by attempting to extra economically intervene and to take this property, to intervene in the very sphere of labor, right? And take this property from them. And basically what's important here is Locke is enunciating a revolution on the basis of the labor theory of value, a monarchy that is parasitic, a monarchy that does not work, a king that does not transform nature, a king that is not essentially a bourgeois subject, is intervening in social life, is extracting from our transformation of nature, our labor, our private property, and serving an affront both to the objective natural social world and to our transcendent subjective consciousness. It's an affront to it. And therefore, there has to be the deposition of this king and the erection of a new king. But what's clear in this erection of a new king is essentially that they're now being given the title. And when they're given the title, they sign a bill called the Declaration of Rights. And this essentially means that they can't overrule Parliament. And now Parliament is the source of sovereign authority. Parliament, which is elected, really it's only elected at this point by between, say, 2% and 8% of the people, but it's viewed more or less as the popular authority tribune of the nation as a whole, and it's Parliament who locks these monarchs, because Parliament says, and the key, and this is the key initiative, the most important thing in the entire revolutionary settlement, which all the revolutionaries and Whigs and Republicans put their entire effort into, is one thing: the king cannot approve money bills. Now, this may seem like some kind of crude economic determinism, but it's that which means that the king cannot raise revenue and resources from the population without parliamentary approval, which means that there cannot be extra economic extraction. But the tracts on this, if you read them, are much more socially and philosophically rich and really about the fact that the king can no longer arbitrarily intervene in the producers who transform nature through their labor and create property. And ergo, the king can no longer be an affront to that natural order of things. That's arbitrary power, the intervention in civil society without the approval of civil society itself. The attempt to grasp the products of man's labor without reference to man's reason and consciousness and persuasion itself, right? And this is really the key category. So locking them in to that parliamentary approval of finance is, in a sense, ending arbitrary power, ending the ability to extra-economically extract a surplus, to construct the absolutist state that rules above civil society instead of through it. And the securing of the parliamentary regime means that you now rule through civil society. Now, this happens in these two regions of the globe, and I'm wrapping up here. This happens in these two regions of the globe, and what's clear is both in the case of the Dutch, and here's one more picture of the Glorious Revolution, forget about the, what happens in the case of the Dutch and in the case of the English is it's really on the basis of a labor theory of value that all the subsequent categories are developed. Private property, the market, and they argue that the Habsburg monarchy and the Stuart monarchy, these monarchs that are pursuing this absolutist state apparatus, that they are parasitic elements, unproductive, that intervene in the private sphere of civil society, the sphere of commodity exchange and the division of labor, and they interfere in this. And this is the category on which all these revolutions are launched. And all three of them, the Dutch Revolt, the English Civil Wars in the mid-17th century, and the Glorious Revolution of 1689, have a mass basis. That is, everyone understands their interests. Everyone understands their self-understanding to be wrapped up and involved with the overthrow of these regimes. And the instantiation of regimes that supposedly represent their reason, their will, their consciousness in some type of legislative assembly of rational debate, right? Be it the Estates General in the Netherlands or the Parliament, the House of Commons, the House of Lords in England. And this is how they understand themselves. And they understand that at various moments of time there's going to be corruption or there's going to be limits to this system, but it's a system that can kind of unfold from itself, meaning that there can be continuous critique saying, well, we established that in 1688, but now we're in 1710, and these guys have gotten too corrupt and they're too unrepresentative, so we need to extend the system of representation. But you see how once you've subsumed the state to civil society, you can have a never-ending process of the democratization of the state that is no longer necessarily revolutionary. That is, in a sense of rising up and overthrowing an arbitrary regime and instituting a new one that can be a reform of that regime. And the Netherlands and England largely do simply reform themselves into mass democratization. And they don't require 19th century revolutions to happen. Now, the final thing, and I want, because this puts us into Richard, is, meanwhile, even though I've concentrated so far on, I want to take us way back to this map, even though I had concentrated on these regions, right? The bourgeois revolutions in these regions constitute them as modern nation states, right? As England and the Netherlands as we know them. But really, their effects are not contained within those categories. Meaning from the 13th and 14th century, they've been having a dynamic effect, a pull on the feudal, non-capitalist areas around them. And what's key about this is twofold. One, the feudal absolutist states that are in competition with one another are increasingly, once the Netherlands and England emerge, under much superior competition from states that can call on a capitalist productive economy. And this is key because even though the revolts of the Netherlands and England are against taxation without representation, these are not cheap people who just are against paying taxes. It's bound up with the structure of social and political relations that they refuse to give their economic contribution to if the social and political order doesn't look a certain way. And once they look this way, the Dutch and the English pour more money into their kings and their sovereigns that has ever been poured into a state apparatus before in human history. And this creates a dynamic where the Dutch and the English are defeating everyone over the entire world.
Yeah, over the entire world, because by the late 17th century, the Dutch are the supremes of maritime power.
Absolutely.
And have colonies throughout the world. And there's a, you know, for this tiny country in Europe, they're a force to be reckoned with globally.
Exactly. So they're defeating everyone, and they're defeating everyone. And within this, so what happens is you begin to have at the level of the states themselves in other feudal absolutist polities, you begin to have a desire to introduce transformations that will allow them to increase the fiscal resources that they can have to compete with one another and to defeat the Netherlands and England. And you see a process from the 17th century on in places like Brandenburg, Prussia, was eventually Prussia, France, other places. Colbert famously tries to introduce capitalist manufacture overnight in France, right? That is, you still got peasants in control and means of production, but after that's emerged, it's no longer necessary to constantly have the dumping of peasants out to have a capitalist relation. I have to really summarize this quickly. So what happens is, at the level of the bureaucracy, the bureaucrats work for the king. They have to figure out how to get resources for the king so the king can extend his bodily, physical sovereignty over increasing spaces of Europe. To do this, they begin to rationalize, to introduce capitalist manufacture, to try and figure out what's going on in other areas that's causing this dynamic growth and is leading them to actually become much more productive and be able to dispose of more resources to use in this state competition between one another. In a similar hand, you also have a pull, because the Netherlands and England are now mass centers of mass demand, because you have people now who are divorcing the means of production and are purchasing everything, right, from the market. Basically, in other regions of Europe which produce for those regions can start to produce much more. So in France, you see certain luxury industries in the 17th and 18th century transform themselves into a capitalist direction, despite the fact that the peasants are still in control of the means of production, because they've got this mass demand outside in the Netherlands, in England. So the point is, even though I took this through a nation-state framework to show the bourgeois revolution, this commodification of labor power, which only really becomes limited to a nation-state, it never becomes limited, but only has a nation-state name after the bourgeois revolution, but it's exhibiting a dynamism throughout all of Europe that's forcing changes elsewhere. These bureaucrats that are now in these major absolutist states that have to figure out how to economically extract resources from the population are now trying to figure out, what is it that these strange Dutch and English are doing? Why is it that they have a dynamic economy that's growing? How do we introduce capitalist industry? Merchants within feudal towns in France and Prussia and Austria and other areas are saying, they're getting ever increasing demand from Dutch and English and other markets. Therefore, they want to produce more. They can shift to a capitalist direction without having to worry about their peasant countryside anymore, because there is enough of a mass demand. And basically, you start to see at the level of civil society, transformations within individual economic units, and at the level of the bureaucratic state, transformations within the bureaucratic state itself to introduce capitalist productive relations within society, basically. And this also happens at an intellectual level in the sense that in the 17th century, the Netherlands and England, most famously embodied in Hobbes and Locke and Newton and Bacon in England, and most famously embodied in Spinoza in the Netherlands, and Descartes. I mean, he's French, but there's a very important way in which his story is bound up with the emergence of the Dutch Revolt and the modern Netherlands, and that's where he attributes, he begins thinking through the subject-object split. And there's no accident that he begins thinking through the character of the subject-object split in the Netherlands. But anyway, let's forget about that for now. Now, the key point here is this, is these areas, you start to get the spread of Enlightenment philosophy, you get people reading across European state borders, political economy, and Spinoza, Hobbes, metaphysics, rational philosophy, political critiques of the old regime. This is all spreading. So at the level of bureaucratic state level, social, economic level, and intellectual critical consciousness level, the pull of these regions is affecting all of Western Europe, right? It's no one is not outside of this effect,
also
essentially.
The end of the 17th century is when the Atlantic, the slave trade out of Africa, really kicks into high gear. Because it existed prior to that, but it really kicks into high gear in this period.
That's absolutely right. And the height of this development I want to give you is the physiocrats. And the physiocrats are the first real theorists of value. It's in France. And physiocrats are bureaucrats and administrators and philosophers within the old regime itself, right? That are hired by the king to figure out how to produce his ability to extract fiscal resources and basically to work political economy, how to organize society to be as productive as possible so that the king can have as much wealth as possible with which to keep himself and to fight warfare against his other sovereigns. And it's the physiocrats who begin to theorize what the nature of value is, right?
This is later, 1750.
No, this is the middle of the 18th century. Yeah, exactly. This is what I'm saying. It's the high middle of the 18th century. And what's key here is it's the physiocrats who begin to say that there's some substance called value. They reduce it to the land, and I think it has to do with the way the peasant possession continues in France. and you don't have as much industry and commerce, but let's forget about that for a minute. The point is, they begin to theorize, and they try and think about the reforms that can happen to the social order that basically will make it more productive. And the physiocrats are thinking through this in the face of France's defeat. France has been defeated by England and the Netherlands in the Nine Years' War, which lasts from 1688 to 1697. They've been defeated again in the War of the Spanish Succession, which is 1703 to 1714. They've been defeated again in the War of the Austrian Succession, which happens in the 1740s and early 1750s. So they're defeated in this warfare between with England again and again, and this causes ever-increasing crises in France. It's got less fiscal resources to use against England and the Netherlands. It continuously gets beat against them. Its administrators begin thinking about these societies. There are already philosophers participating in these salons, these private meeting houses in Paris and Lyon and Marseille and other areas where they themselves are receiving the spread of Enlightenment thought and political economy. And the physiocrats try and theorize value, and they try and theorize how the French socioeconomic order can be transformed in such a way that they can more or less have what they view as this ever-growing economy, this ever-increasing wealth accumulation, this end of economic coercion, and this sphere of autonomy that other societies appear to have. Because, of course, the English and Dutch civil society is flourishing, coffee houses, printing presses, most literate societies in Europe. 50% of people in both of these areas are outside of agriculture and are participating in commerce and manufacturing. And this is the double bind of French state and society. That is, the state increasingly encourages, over the course of the 18th century in France, increasingly encourages bourgeois society to grow in many initiatives and ways. But when bourgeois society begins to demand that the form of the state itself be liberal, right, that the state be representative, right, begins to resist the extra economic contributions the state is leveling, begins to resist what they view as an arbitrary will acting against natural reason, this makes the monarchy pull back. And so so we're dealing in the old regime France with neither feudalism or a modern sort of capitalist state.
There's a great scene in Jefferson in Paris where they, at a certain point, the king's advisors realize that the third estate is making too extreme demands. And so even though the king has, and you know, the sort of aristocratized bureaucracy has entertained the estate's general meeting and discussing various demands, that at a certain point they tell the king, well, just go out and tell them that you're still the king and that you're not going to take any more demands. And he does that, and of course this is the beginning of the revolution.
Exactly. So you see this double bind. They're still kings. They still want the old territorial absolutist state order. They're introducing bourgeois society, though, to try and keep that order in competition with other states. But they also try and prevent the rise of that society. It's a real double bind. And it's not craziness. They bring Turgot, they bring Necker into power. These are basically philosophes who have cut their teeth in Swiss and French salons, where they're debating political economy, art treatises, aesthetic theory, early liberal political theory, Locke, Newton, Spinoza. They bring these civil society figures in who are not aristocratic lords, or only recently so. They're nobles of the robe, which means they're not inherited nobles. They've just been given it in recognition for their honors or the money they've paid. And they bring these guys in, and these guys are basically the representatives of a kind of free, self-determining civil society that can instantiate its own reason, and in which the monarchy, therefore, brings these guys in, and then when they start calling for all their radical demands, the monarchy throws them out. And it throws these guys out one after another in the 18th century. You come in, we reform a bit, the demands become too much, we throw you out. And in the aftermath of the Seven Years' War, where England has defeated them across the globe, and with Richard has put up there the dates, in the aftermath of the American Revolution,
the French and Indian War.
The French and Indian War.
It's actually a global war.
And in the aftermath of the American Revolution, which, as Chris said last time from the movie Marie Antoinette, apparently there's a scene where Louis says his counselors basically say to him, "Front the Americans." Go ahead, say the scene.
Right, and Marie, right. That we have to show our strength by funding the American Revolution. And even though he's like, well, doesn't this mean, you know, undermining the rights of kings? And they're like, well, it doesn't matter, because, you know, we're in this national struggle with England, and we have to weaken England by supporting America.
That's exactly it. And so they've lost money in the French in the Seven Years' War. They want to get revenge at Britain. They support the American Revolution. This costs them an immense amount of money. It's important because the American Revolution would have been unsuccessful, or only at least partially successful, without the support of France. And that's really key. And basically, I'm not going to cover the American Revolution, but basically what happens is they're now bankrupt, and France needs money, and it decides to try and introduce a new land taxation scheme. And the parlements, which are not like parliament in England, but are local juridical courts made up of largely aristocrats or bureaucratic appointments, begin to resist this, and they refuse to levy this. And basically what happens is this onsets a process where from 1786 to 1788, there are all these debates, and all these pamphlets are published about what should we do, how do we get the money, the monarchy's running out of money, we've got to compete with Austria, we've got to compete with Prussia, how do we introduce all of these things that are going to allow stuff to happen. What happens is they finally come up with, let's call the Estates General. Now, the Estates General is a classic feudal estates divided between those who pray, the clerics, the first estate, those who fight, the sword-wielding, horse-riding noblemen, the second estate, and those who work, which is the third estate, which is everyone else. Peasants, merchants, manufacturers, artisans, shopkeepers, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what happens is they try and divide this, and they say, you'll each have an equal amount of representatives. The first estate, the second estate, the third estate. The problem is not that it ever was equal under feudalism, but with the growth of bourgeois society, this totally appears ridiculous to many, many people. Lawyers, shopkeepers, professionals, doctors, for which they have expanded immensely since the 16th and 17th centuries. And they basically, what happens is they begin to demand initially more representation. And finally the king's ministers give it and say, we'll double the third estate. And it will be equal to the first and second. The clerics and the noblemen will be equal to the third estate. And here's where you get a very famous pamphlet by the Abbé Sieyès, who is basically a radical French philosopher, and he writes, what is the third estate in 1788-89 when everyone's debating, and finally the ministers come out and say, oh, well, we'll double the third estate, and the first and second and the third, first and second will have equal to the third, and Sieyès says, no way. And his basic response is, sorry about this, his basic response is, he writes, now this is key, and this really connects to the Dutch, Pierre Delacour, and the British Locke, sense, and Adam Smith, the sense of the labor theory of value as the essence of the bourgeois critique of the old regime, and also the essence in which the third estate, the bourgeoisie, is understood even by themselves as a category of bourgeois subjectivity, not as the middle class. It's only the subsequent degradation of historiography that this is understood as people with economic interests, largely merchants and manufacturers that want to overthrow the old feudal lords. Everyone understands this as a revolt of the bourgeois, the third estate, as a revolt of everyone who transforms labor, everyone who's independent, because they depend only on their transformation of labor to reproduce themselves, and they're not dependent parasites who live off of other people. This is in their own self-understanding, like kings and lords. Right? And therefore, they are independent. Their independence allows their rationality to have full reason, because it's not circumscribed by their needs and their dependency by others. And Sieyès will say, what he says, since the earth and waters furnish crude products for the needs of man, the first class and logical sequence will be that all families. But anyways, he goes through peasants who labor, merchants who buy the goods, ship the goods, add their own labor, manufacturers refine the raw materials and add their own labor, shopkeepers store them, put them in their shops, and add their own labor time. And it's basically an entire analysis of the transformation of nature, the use of concrete labor, the commitment of a labor time to something, which then improves the product and allows it to be sold and allows for the reproduction, sorry, of society as a whole, right? And he writes, so he writes, between production and consumption, as well as between the various stages of production, a group of intermediary agents establish themselves, useful to both producers and consumers. These are the merchants and brokers. The brokers who, comparing incessantly the demands of time and place, speculate upon the profit of retention and transportation. Merchants who are charged with distribution, the last analysis, either wholesale or retail. This species of utility characterizes the third class. Anyway, he keeps going and going and going. And he's basically...
It's impossible to follow you.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
When you're talking about what the third estate understands themselves as the class of people who are independent, so of course we're talking about workers here who are essentially artisanal, or peasants who are like quasi-freeholders. I'm talking about like men, whatever. Like in other words, people who have independence relative to, you know, another aspect of society which is more patriarchal because there's, you know, there are slaves and there are women and whatnot, children, But, you know, would people attribute the master-slave dialectic of Hegel, like as an attempt to summarize this entire consciousness of the third estate? All right, in other words, the third estate is the master-slave dialectic of Hegel, the offspring of the slaves who have established their independence. Right, because the master-slave dialectic is meant to trace the emergence from pre-modern into bourgeois society. Right, so that's... The master-slave dialectic doesn't apply to bourgeois society because bourgeois society everyone is independent. It's rather, how did that independence come about? That's what the master-slave dialectic is about.
No, that's and in 1789, in the production of pamphlets, Sieyès is the first one to actually say the third estate co-equals the nation. That is, there is nothing in France that's outside of the third estate, and the third estate has yet to actually be represented in France. And contained within this is the logic of the elimination of the king already. He's essentially been beheaded with the publication of this pamphlet, and it reads...
And the aristocracy.
What's key here, though, is the aristocracy are even endorsing this to some extent. I mean, of course, it's all... So who then shall dare to say... Right. Who then shall dare to say that the third estate has not within itself all that is necessary for the formation of a complete nation? It is the strong and robust man who has one arm still shackled. If the privileged order should be abolished, the nation would be nothing less but something more. Therefore, what is the third estate? Everything. But in everything shackled and oppressed. Again, it's been unfolded from a category of labor and those who take the labor without recompensing. Right? It's already the traditional Marxist critique. What would it be without the privileged order? Everything. But in everything, free and flourishing. Their labor, free from a parasitic or privileged class, free to transform nature in their own direction. And if we read the rest of these pamphlets, to unfold a process of limitless wealth accumulation, prosperity driving a process of eliminating direct coercion from human life, and autonomy, self-determining rational activity. It is. Then he writes at the end, what is the nation? Oh, sorry. What is the nation, right? A body of associates living under the common law and represented by the same legislator, etc. It is not evident that the noble order has privileges and expenditures, what it dares to call rights, but what are apart from the rights of the great body of citizens. It departs there from the common law. So its civil rights make of it an isolated people in the midst of the great nation. This is truly imperium in imperia. Okay, now he writes at the end, the third estate embraces then all that which belongs to the nation, and that all that which is not the third estate cannot be regarded as being of the nation. What is the third estate? It is the whole, right? Now, this is the pamphlets that call for the creation of a legislator that's equal to the nation as a whole, all those who contribute their labor, with the exclusion, elimination of all those who are simply parasites that rely on it, right? And basically what happens is that in response to this radicalization, all these pamphlets being produced, the third estate, that is the deputies that have been sent from the provinces that are taking their place in the traditional feudal tripartite order of clerics, noblemen, and those who work, everything from peasants to classic bourgeois, merchants, manufacturers, they all basically declare their national assembly and they represent the people. And basically, fuck this system that's been set up where we're going to have just a double of our representation. These first two no longer matter. It's out. We're the National Assembly. In response to this, the king and his ministers say, in classic 17th, 18th century French fashion, this whole process of quasi-liberalization is over. We brought back the Estates General, but now we're withdrawing it. The king has a lit de justice, which means he represents his body physically before the public and says, this is over, this is recalled. In response to this, the third estate, all the deputies who exist in this third assembly, occupy a tennis court because they've been locked out of their meeting place. Because they've been essentially said, it's over, the king has declared the end of this. And they say, the king can't declare the end of this. The nation goes on irrespective of the king. Right? It's not the king is dead, long live the king. It's the nation always continues, and the king serves more or less at his behest. And they take, as Richard called it, what is known as the tennis court oath in 1789, which is all the members of the third estate, largely lawyers, doctors, professionals at this point, with a few merchants, manufacturers, a few large peasants, and wealthy artisans, all take the oath to say, we will not dissolve the National Assembly. It is permanent. The nation is permanent. Ergo, the National Assembly that represents it is totally permanent, right? And this basically, I'll let Richard take over the rest of the process, but the point is...
Can you go back to that image?
Yeah, sorry.
To mention it.
No, go ahead.
This picture is, of course, by David.
Yes, it's Jacques-Louis David.
But the fascinating anecdote is that David, because of his fascination with classical antiquity, he actually drew all of these figures nude. And there's a picture of them all nude, which is the original version. And he put the clothes on, the 18th century clothes on, the classical nudes later, even though this was a contemporary historical event.
No, that's absolutely right. And basically, there's a process where various reactionaries and monarchs, and I'll let Richard get into the particulars, try, because they have the means of violence at their disposal, to shut down this process. And eventually, what gets mobilized are the masses of Paris themselves, who destroy the Bastille. The Bastille is the key prison of the old regime, where they keep political prisoners. Now, by this point, it's empty in the sense that they're not really keeping common thieves in anymore. There are a few political prisoners, the most famous to this day being the Marquis de Sade, who's in there at the storming of Bastille and actually encourages the revolutionaries outside to invade and later write sort of sexual fantasies about the whole thing. But the point is that they destroy the Bastille, and when the Bastille is destroyed, even though it's really only functioning as a small prison for a few political prisoners that could never really be a threat to the regime, across Europe there are widespread celebrations. In England, the great enemy of France in this period, widespread celebrations. It's more or less viewed when the Bastille is destroyed as the destruction of the old regime, of the having brought down by mass action. And it appears in its own act, when people write about it, is the laboring nation rises up, expresses itself naturally, and smashes the unnatural, overtly coercive, hierarchical ancient order and destroys it. And people read this as the death of extra economic coercion, as the death of overt hierarchy, overt domination, and as the expression of basically a repressed natural laboring population that finally has its freedom to pursue its own ends in civil society and autonomy to determine both its own individual self and its future, freed from guilds, peasant village communities, lordly aristocratic communities, merchant companies that since the beginning of life set its own principles. And what's key about this is you all know the filmmaker John Carpenter. Well, the horror filmmaker. John Carpenter exists for us, and his name is a classic medieval name, right? Jean Carpenter in France, Jean Carpenter in England, all over the place, a classic medieval name. John Carpenter today is John Carpenter, the member of civil society, the filmmaker, the individual, and also John Carpenter, the abstract citizen of the United States, right? The abstract legal formal citizen of the US. John Carpenter in the Middle Ages is someone who's determined from the beginning, born into a journeyman or artisan family. He will be a carpenter his whole life. He will practice his guild in a certain way. That is, there's no public or private distinction in the Middle Ages between people, right? And so many people write about the smashing of the Bastille as the creation of a public-private distinction. That is, as the elimination of an overt coercion or a mode of life that sets the ends of your life at the beginning of your life. So the smashing of the Bastille is also the freedom of your subjective consciousness, the freedom to determine yourself and your own ends, how you live your life, and in communion with others, how you'll determine your collective life together, right? It's no longer that you're set from the beginning in a village community of peasants and you have this land and you'll work and you'll pay to this lord, or your lordly aristocrat who is the Duke de Z or the Marquis de X, who serves over set populations.
The symbolic of that is that when James talks about the Bastille as being the political prisoners, what that means is those are prisoners whose crimes have been against the king.
Well,
yes.
All
that's
right.
Absolutely
so
right.
What they're saying is we don't care about crimes against the king. The king is nobody. Like there are no crimes that are committed against the king, right? So they're not like eliminating like prisons in general. They're saying this particular class's crime is eliminated.
But the other thing is that what the Bastille is associated with is the lettre de cachet, which is
an arbitrary order to imprison anyone.
But arbitrary order not for people who are accused of any crimes. In the 18th century, in the 18th century, you know, families or people could get, like, you didn't want somebody you wanted that way, you could buy a lettre de cachet, and people could just, by arbitrary order of the king, without having committed any crime, be indefinitely imprisoned, which was seen as symbolic of the great abuse of the constant version here.
Absolutely, right.
Because yeah, well, it does happen. It happens. Yeah. Like, that's the horror. It's like, actually, like, the atrocities of the present are vastly worse than the atrocities of the Alzheimer's. But in the 18th century, these things were horrible.
Right. Did you want to say something, Chris?
No, you could pay like one of the king's agents a bribe to get your like competitor, like your business competitor, or up to.
No, that's and now the Dutch revolt was a revolt of a province away from a monarchy in which the monarchical structure is less intact. The English Civil War and Glorious Revolution is the revolt against the monarch that rules within the country, but now will introduce a new monarch chosen at the behest of the people. And it's the French Revolution that really begins to emerge with its own self-understanding for the first time of the elimination of the old order completely. And the instantiation of a new one from within that regime itself. It's not a province that broke away from a monarchy and the monarchy stays intact. And it's not also, in the English sense, simply that you brought a new king, elected him. It's a kingdom that existed as the Kingdom of France circa 1788, and now circa 1790 understands itself as the nation of France. A totally different order transformed. And
they don't get rid of the king right away.
They have
a constitutional monarchy, and there's like a couple of kings, both the Marie Antoinette and then Jefferson in Paris, where they show the royal couple being taken out of Versailles, being brought to France in order to be closer to the people. Because it's kind of like, well, okay, so, you know, I think I talked about this before, about how the monarchy and then the aristocracy were large is like the show dogs of the society. Because it's kind of like, well, there are kings and queens, so we want them near us. They shouldn't be in Versailles, they should be in Paris. And, you know, there are pets. And so there is, even though the monarchy is not abolished, there's a fundamental transformation in how the role of the monarchy.
Well, they were trying to British it.
Right. They're right. Trying to make it into a constitutional monarchy.
Right, exactly. And what happens is in 1791 they pass the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of Citizen from the people of France. And basically...
Which was written, by the way.
It's written, it doesn't get passed in the constitutional order until 91.
It's written, by the way, by the Marquis de Lafayette, who is the hero of the American Revolution. The leader of the French expedition.
And if you look at all these things, they literally instantiate all the systems of civil society, freedom of the press, freedom of association, civil society itself, the autonomous self-determining individuals can come together, express their reason and rationality, free from coercion, and determine the collective life best. And this is written in the order of at the heart of the state itself. So again, it's a bourgeois revolution as civil society's conquest over the state, which has happened in the Dutch Revolt, the English Civil War, the Glorious Revolution, but it has achieved its highest fulfillment in the French Revolution itself in its liberal phase from 89 to 92. And what should be just said here by way of this is Kant's What is Enlightenment, finally, is published in 1784, and it's published in a Berlin newspaper, and what essentially is, in classic philosoph fashion, they put out an advertisement, and they ask for people to write in and say, well, everybody's saying this age of enlightenment and the freedom of civil society, and what is this all about? And they get 17 responses from very, very famous philosophers, many of whom have been lost to history because they didn't write any great treatises. The second most famous after Kant is Moses Mendelssohn. But the first is Kant himself, but although he's not recognized as such at the time. But the key is Kant writes this response, and in it, he defines the slogan or the expression of enlightenment fundamentally as sapere aude, dare to know, right? And he unfolds it as dare to understand yourself. But also, and this is key, he doesn't pitch it at the level of priests and kings anymore, circa the English revolutions and the Dutch revolts. He doesn't pitch it at the level of kings and priests have fooled us and conspired and turned us against ourselves. He pitches it at the level of self-incurred immaturity, that people themselves are responsible for their own darkness, ignorance, backwardness.
Human beings emerges from his self-incurred minority.
Or, right, okay.
The outside this mention, outside of sense, different from media.
But that can mean immaturity or sort
minority
of...
Minority meaning like...
Minority, exactly, childlike infancy, child. Exactly. So they mean the same thing, basically, right? Mm-hmm. And so basically, the point is, though, is in this treatise in 1784, Kant's a huge fan of the revolution, the French Revolution. But in this treatise, he's got this kind of distinction where, well, you can privately exercise your reason as much as you want to, but publicly you have to obey. And in a sense, he's expressing in a philosophical manner the kind of classic tension of the European continental monarchies that are furthering their bourgeois civil societies, but at the same time stepping back from them. Which is to say, increasingly want the development of bourgeois society, but are worried about its more liberal implications. And so, in a sense, Kant comes into his own in his support for the French Revolution because it's finally where it no longer requires a kind of submission or an absolute obedience in a public realm itself. Of course, the modern state requires that.
But what he means by public and private is kind of curious. Because public means the overtly political realm. So a lot of what we would take to be public, he actually puts in the private sphere. Like, for instance, if you are a bureaucrat, right, exercising your job, like not trying to make policy decisions, but just sort of exercising your authority as a bureaucrat, he calls that your private conduct.
Yes, that's.
And so the public-private distinction in this essay actually doesn't correspond to our assumption.
Right.
Because the public is actually quite narrow, whereas for us the public is quite broad. Like, in other words, for us it's kind of like private sphere is what you do in your home.
Right.
Right. And what you do on the job is like quasi-public. Whereas for Kant, it's like you can have a governmental job and doing your job is considered your private duty.
He concentrates on like religion and like the priestly order or something. He says that it's like if you were at the pulpit, you wouldn't preach to your like congregation your own opinions on the teachings. You would follow what would be like prescribed, but then in your own kind of reflections on religion, that would be your kind of private sphere, right? I mean, that's the way he...
Right, but that brings up the freedom of conscience, though, which is a little bit different.
Yes.
But
Kant enunciates this category of Bildung, enlightenment, education, in the sense of self-development. That is, one educates oneself to know the world, to understand the world, to be able to control one's self-activity in the world, and ultimately to achieve the goals of autonomy. Right, of both your own freedom, your own independence, which were the goals of the bourgeois revolutionaries. And I would argue that really what is enlightenment, that the French Revolution, that peculiarity Chris points towards in Kant's expression, is something that can be resolved after the French Revolution has its influence across Europe. That is, it can fully emerge into a more regular routine, what we understand today, public-private distinction. But what's really, I think, just important to say, and Richard is taking over, I guess, not now, but when he comes back. So I'll just say one final thing, which is this, which is, of course, now living after Marx, we know the famous expression, which is the point is only not only to understand the world, but to change it, right? Which is commonly cited and commonly said. And of course, in a way, though, it's premised on Kant saying saperade, dare to know. That is, it's premised, the necessary preface to Marx is this turn in the latent enlightenment towards the idea that the world is not something that is simply controlled by you conspiratorially by priests, aristocrats, kings who fool you, that play lights on images and caves and like Plato's Republic analogy, et cetera, but rather it's your own self-incurred immaturity, it's your own responsibility, it's your own social relations between human beings, it's the own world you self-constitute yourself, sorry, it's the own world, objective world which you constitute through yourself, that you yourself have been what you are, benighted, backwards, unenlightened, et cetera, et cetera. And now it's he who turns towards the slogan of know yourself, which really becomes Marx's, the preface point, the point of departure for Marx, in the sense that, yes, there is a desire to transform or change the world, but it's premised on the idea that you understand the world, that you actually try and learn how it socially functions, how it came to be constituted the way it is, what roles human self-activity have in this determination. And that necessarily means that, or complicates the relationship, which I was saying in the last session, between the values or ideals of the bourgeois revolution and their expression in political economy enlightenment, and the left. That is, what is the left's point of departure from those ideals? How does it transform? And the one thing I want to say before transferring to Richard is, there's a very common postmodernist gesture. I won't say it comes out of Ricoeur, but a lot of people like to quote Ricoeur, Paul Ricoeur's famous Freud, Nietzsche, Marx are the masters of suspicion, right? By which, in a sense, in the postmodern gesture, it comes to mean that Freud, Nietzsche, and Marx undermine the Enlightenment ideals of peace, prosperity, and ultimately autonomy, self-determination, that they destroyed it, that they showed it to be the shab, the nonsense, the emptiness that it was, right? But there's a wholly other way in which such things can be approached. Sorry, Richard?
They're the heirs of the Enlightenment.
Yes, there's a wholly other way in which such things can be approached. And we've discussed this heavily in the Marx class, heavily in our Marx readings for this group. When Chris did Lukács and Hegel and other people presented on the Grundrisse, so, and we discuss, and there's a way, if you look at the work of Robert Pippin, discusses this very influentially with Nietzsche, and then Elie Zaretsky discusses this very cogently with Freud, right? Which is that Freud, Nietzsche, and Marx have as their point of departure not the meaningless of these ideals, but what conditions can these ideals really be achieved under? How does one actually have autonomy? What does autonomy mean? How does one self-determine, right? So rather than the postmodernist gesture of psychoanalysis, the unconscious undermining rationality, or Marx's economic interest showing the ideals of the bourgeois revolution to be particular massive class exploitation, or Nietzsche understanding basically the deception involved at the discourse of modernity, rather that these people are all concerned with embodying modernity's fullest potential. Right, and if we're going to see these thinkers, as I think we do, as key influences on the left, particularly Marx and Freud, then really we have to rephrase what their engagement with the highest enlightenment ideals of autonomy and the bourgeois revolutions actually are. And I think in doing that, then we might fulfill what the Louis Menand introduction to the Finlandization by Edmund Wilson says, which is seeing Marx and Engels as philosophers of the second enlightenment in that respect. But now I leave you with 89. The outbreak of the French Revolution, and Richard is essentially going to take over from there, right?
Wait a second. No cigarette break, bathroom break.
Oh, God.
5 minutes.
No questions? Just hit stop.